We're looking at diet and nutrition today on Focus with a return visit from David Grotto. He's a registered dietitian and licensed dietitian and nutritionist whose latest book is The Best Things You Can Eat for Everything from Aches to Z's. David's advice is not one size fits all. His food and nutrition recommendations are based on particular needs and situations, and he'll be sharing some of those tips today on Focus. We welcome your calls and emails on everything from the pluses and minuses of various nutrients to which foods are best for supplying them, how much protein do we need, and what's the best source for it, and when is it wise to turn to nutritional supplements. I'm Jim Meadows, and nutritionist and dietitian David Grotto joins us for Focus on WILL. That's coming up after this hour's news. Good morning, I'm Jim Meadows, and this is Focus. David Grotto was the guest on Focus back in February with our previous host, Craig Cohen, and he fielded lots of questions back then about what foods can provide which benefits. He's back on Focus today, ready to provide more answers about what foods are good for you and in what ways. David Grotto writes about diet and nutrition in his blog, David Grotto's Nutrition House Call. And if you Google Nutrition House Call, it should come up. He's also published books on the subject, the latest of which is The Best Things You Can Eat for Everything from Aches to Z's, published under the DiCapo Lifelong imprint. David Grotto, welcome back to Focus.
Oh, it's great to be back on.
You know, I wanted to, a lot of people have advice on what to eat. But you do identify yourself as a registered dietitian and a licensed dietitian and nutritionist. And I thought maybe to start off, we could unpack what those titles mean and what sort of qualifications you bring to the subject.
Absolutely. In fact, the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, formerly known as the American Dietetic Association, has further defined the credentials. So RD, which stands for Registered Dietitian, is now becoming RDN. So they've now not only changed the name of the organization, but also the credential. And hopefully this will help consumers, because though I've been a spokesperson for the organization trying to enlighten the consumer of who are nutritionists with proper background, now we have a credential that says Registered Dietitian Nutritionist. So people will hopefully finally know what an RD is.
Okay. There's certain things that people should look for as far as if they want to, talk to somebody or read writing from somebody who is truly trained in the subject of diet and nutrition?
Yes. It's interesting. My daughter goes to middle school, and I actually gave a presentation to her seventh grade class, and they were all elated to hear that each one of them could actually be a card-carrying member of a nutritionist organization without having to go through any sort of schooling. So the term nutritionist, unfortunately, is not regulated, but registered dietitian is. So that requires a minimum of a four-year. Most RDs right now actually carry a master's degree that's accredited, and they have to go through an internship program to actually have hands-on work with real-life patients. So it's not just a book learning, but it actually is also a practical experience as well.
And the LDN title, does that require some practical experience also?
Yes, each state either has elected to have licensure or not to have licensure. So in the state of Illinois where I practice, I am a licensed dietitian nutritionist.
Okay. We welcome you to the conversation as well. If you have a question for David Grotto, call us at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. David, my first question, I was at the supermarket last night strolling down the aisle in the cereal section, where there seemed to be an awful lot of claims made, some of it about cereal in general, just looking at what looked to be about a dozen varieties of Cheerios and knowing about the advertising they've done. which, if it doesn't say right out directly, it certainly very strongly implies that eating Cheerios will prevent heart disease. Is this true?
Well, I would love to say that eating one single food is the magic bullet, the health halo, or should deserve a health halo of, preventing the number one killer of both men and women. I think it's a fairly strong claim unless you read the further fine print, which is generally as part of a heart-healthy lifestyle, which includes a proper diet that's low in saturated and trans fats and so forth and so forth and so on. So this is a problem that I've had all along with looking at individual foods, holding hope that it'll actually turn the bolt around on some of these health challenges we have. So though my first book I wrote, which is called 101 Foods That Could Save Your Life, I make very clear in there that not one single food in and of itself could do that. We really do need to amass all of these healthy foods into a program and lifestyle program that will actually help fight disease.
Nobody wants to hear that, do they?
Well, moderation is not sexy. And I always feel sometimes that being the voice of reason and common sense isn't doing well for book sales. But at the end of the day, I've got to be able to not only look myself in the mirror, but my family, my colleagues, and so forth. And I always pride myself on giving recommendations to everyone based on scientific evidence. And unfortunately, I think what happens is that many Americans get very frustrated when they've gained weight and they want to reverse that trend, or if they develop diabetes or heart disease. We're always looking for a quick fix, a miracle food. And I really wish I could say today that there are an abundance of those quick fix or miracle foods out there that'll, again, turn the boat around. But it really is developing a healthy lifestyle that has been the most effective and most science proven.
Now, in the case of Cheerios and cereals, which are just like Cheerios, I take it the ingredient that they're counting on, it's made from oats.
Correct.
And are oats in that form, however they're processed, for Cheerios a beneficial food?
Well, I give my own personal case study. When I was writing my first book, it was really interesting because I'd never written before except, some late articles and so forth. But I really didn't know how to meet a deadline and got a little panicky about what to do. So I literally was sitting down typing away, and I literally had typed myself out of a healthy lifestyle. While I was telling people about how to control their waistlines, mine expanded. I gained about 20 pounds with that first book. While I was telling people about how I had been one of the first registered dietitians in Chicago to implement a Dean Ornish heart disease reversal program, my cholesterol had soared to 238. And I actually discovered all this while I was counseling firefighters in Chicago. There was a research study that came out said that firefighters were at high risk of dying from a massive heart attack, not actually putting out fires, but gathering the hoses and getting ready to go to the fires. A lot of them had underlying heart disease, and that sudden stress could be their, unfortunately, spelling an early demise for them. So when I had my blood drawn and got that kind of four-alarm fire warning myself, I decided to do something crazy, which was following my own advice. And getting back to your question about Cheerios, I actually added in a bowl of either Cheerios or hot oatmeal or even cold oatmeal. Actually, this all happened during August, and I made a German-style muesli, which is basically just raw oats. And in 1 month of doing that, plus adding in berries, adding in fatty fish, adding in physical activity, I reduced my cholesterol from 238 down to 168. Now, that's a 70-point drop in cholesterol. That's better than what most lipid-lowering medications can do. Now, I want to be very clear. I'm not at all advising the listeners to give up medications or to, even if they've been told they have elevated cholesterol, not to listen to doctors' advice and going on that. But what it did show to me is that engaging in a healthy lifestyle, eating the right diet, can do an amazing number on reducing cholesterol.
Now,
So Cheerios can, I think, or any oat-based product can be part of, and I really want to emphasize, part of a heart-healthy program.
Now, I'm wondering, because I did see on the shelves, along with regular Cheerios, I also saw Frosted Cheerios and Chocolate Cheerios and Fruity Cheerios, which look like Fruit Loops to me. Does that negate the benefits of the oats in the Cheerios when they add those things?
Well, you know, I remember what was it, the Mary Poppins show, a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down. Quite frankly, there are a lot of people who, though they're willing to eat oats or other healthy type products, if it doesn't appease the sweet tooth, it stands little chance of going down. So I get why the folks who make Cheerios may, or any other type of sweetened cereal, may want to add sugar to it to get it to be consumed. Really, if we take a look at the research on sugar itself, it really, its impact has been from contributing empty calories, excess calories to the diet, and we know that puts us at higher risk for diabetes, heart disease, and things of that nature. But if you can eat that sugar-sweetened cereal and balance the calories for the rest of the day, does it make that much difference that there's sugar in the cereal? And I would argue, I don't think at the end of the day it does make any difference. But if you're on the all-sugary sweetened cereal diet and you're eating excessive calories and you're gaining weight, then I would say that is a problem.
So, again, in the context of a balanced diet is what you need to aim for.
Yeah, I know I feel like I'm repeating myself, and we'll continue to do that, but I think we've lost focus of what a balanced diet is, and I'm hoping to further explain that today while we're on. But I think, again, we tend to gravitate to that one single superfood, and we get so fixated on sugar and things of that nature that way I think we lose the forest through the trees.
Well, let's go to our first patient caller. Now, on line number one, Mary Ann from Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. I would like to know if you exercise, say you run, walk 4 miles, lift a few weights, when is the best time to consume the most calories? Is it before exercising or after exercising? And where does the protein come in there?
Sure.
And how much protein?
Okay. Well, there's actually a section in my book, The Best Things You Can Eat, for pre- and post-workout foods. Now, that really addresses more about exercise recovery. And the reason I think that's important in the context of what you're asking about is that, again, people who are so motivated to make lifestyle changes may get very aggressive about doing physical activity, may be in such pain from that physical activity that becomes the deal breaker for them doing more physical activity. So my first recommendation, of course, and especially if you have any underlying disease, always check with your doctor and get a clearance for engaging in a physical activity program. And also start off slow in an a manageable amount of physical activity. The latest research is suggesting that early morning exercise seems to have the most benefit. Do you have to match the amount of calories at the same time that you've done your physical activity? And the answer to that is no. It really is in the context of the entire day. However, everybody is an individual as far as their reaction to food, let's say, before they exercise. So I know, for example, in my case, I don't do really well if I eat a heavy meal before I exercise. But I do need a little something light in my stomach. So really that has to be individualized. The latest, and this kind of dovetails into your question about protein, because it seems to be within a 20-minute period of time post-exercise, your body will selectively take that protein and do a much better job of rebuilding muscle tissue that has become damaged through exercise and build it up better than ever if you consume that protein within 20 minutes after exercise. So I know a lot of people like to take fluid replacement beverages that have electrolytes like Gatorade and things of that nature, and that's fine, but that doesn't help replace the damage done to protein in the muscles, so it's good to eat something that has protein. That could be a low-sodium lunch meat. It can be a nut butter. It can be chocolate milk, as we may have heard about in the news, also being an ideal post-recovery food.
Great.
That's a mouthful.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mary Ann. We're discussing nutrition on today's program, and we welcome your questions for David Grotto, registered dietitian and licensed dietitian and nutritionist and author of The Best Things You Can Eat. Our phone number is 333-9455. Our toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. And we'll be back with more questions for David in just a few minutes. Right now, we need to talk about what makes public radio go. And to do that, we're going to talk with, the producer of Focus, Lindsay Moon, and the content director for Illinois Public Media, David Teal.
Good morning. It's great to be here. And, you know, we've been talking a lot about health, and it made me think, well, you know, what's part of the heart healthy diet for the WILL stations? And frankly, that is our listeners. Not to say that, you know, we're consuming you, but to say that really it's your contributions that really keep the health of these stations and the programming like Focus that we do going. And that's important.
That's exactly right. I'm Lindsay Moon, Focus's producer. And, you know, that is one of the things I love about Focus also is the ability that we get to do shows like this and talk with David and people like him who are experts in a field who can give us advice about things that, you know, might be a little bit more difficult to ask questions about normally. And so far this hour, we've had three people that also enjoy Focus's programming. We'd like to thank Brad and Shelley from Stanford, Illinois. And we want to try and get to 10 by 11 o'clock today. So if you appreciate the programming that you hear on WLL and coming from you from Focus with host Jim Meadows, you can give us a call at 217-244-9455 or pledge online at willpledge.org. And we have a special premium today. And David, can you tell us about that?
Yeah, no, we are offering at the $75 level today the book by our guest, David Grotto. It's The Best Things You Can Eat. And so if you've been like madly writing down notes during this program going, okay, and I can't keep up with all this, it's all here. And it's just, I mean, this is looks like about 300 pages full of lists and just tons and tons of information. I mean, just on all kinds of things. Five best foods to slow down aging. Top five foods to battle cold and flu. I mean, there's just, I'm not even sure how many categories here, but many, many categories. It looks really interesting. I've been flipping through it here during the show. $75, your pledge this morning. We'll make that happen. We can send that to you. 244-9455, willpledge.org if you want to pledge online.
Right. And, you know, The Best Things You Can Eat is full of really useful advice. And one of the nice things about it is it's a book, but it also has a lot of lists in it. So it's easy to take with you to the grocery store. And I madly jot down notes from it before I leave the studio to go to know some of the better things to pick up there. So we are have a $120,000 goal for this pledge drive, and we will stop the drive when we reach that goal. Right now, we're just shy of $80,000. So now is the time to call in, and we know you've been waiting because you love Focus. So give us a call sometime today. Right now, make that at 217-244-9455.
Yeah, really, don't put it off. We're calling this Big Time Thursday, and we really want to, you know, push. We want to get as close as we can to that $120,000 by the end of the day. But, you know, honestly, the sooner the better, because, you know, at that point, we stop doing what we're doing, stop pledging. We don't come back until October if we meet that goal. So that's right. Why we want to hear from you today. 244-9455.
And we'll get back to the show.
Thank you, Lindsay. And we're back on Focus with David Grotto. And let's take another call on line one. Eleanor in Champaign, good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Hi, David. This is complicated. I am desperately hoping that someday there will be a dietitian who can work with people who have Barrett syndrome and GERD, because all they tell you is just try different foods and cross out the ones that don't work. Well, it's not that simple, because you never know whether, you know, when you get older, you have a problem because medications are involved that slow down your motility, and everything. It becomes very, very complicated. Some doctor told me, do you chew gum? Well, you know, I didn't know why I should or should not be chewing gum. Do you puree things? And do you have to puree every? It's complicated. So that's my question, and what I would like to have is a specialist for this instead of just dietitian that doesn't deal with it.
Well, you're talking to the right guy, Because I am someone who has been diagnosed with GERD. I have also other family members, one who does have Barrett's esophagus. Mm-hmm. So this is a topic that is near and dear to my heart. In fact, for those of you who are not familiar with what GERD is, that stands for gastroesophageal reflux disease, somewhat of a fancy word for chronic heartburn. And what happens is you have what's called a little valve or sphincter that's job is to keep the contents of your stomach where they need to be, is in your stomach and not back in your esophagus. And what happens to some individuals is that this sphincter gets loose, if you will, and allows some of the products of the stomach to reflux and back. So if you've seen all those Nexium commercials and so forth, that is targeted to folks like us and our caller today who are having difficulties with that. For some people, it can be due to weight, so simply managing their weight. And, in fact, as I mentioned with my first book, I gained weight with that. I did notice that after I lost the 20 to 25 pounds that I gained, I was able to control my GERD fairly well. Some people also require a dilation technique where a gastroenterologist will actually go in with what's called an endoscope and actually dilate that area that has become constricted with scar tissue from all the acid splashing back up. And some people, post-dilation, or even if they don't need that dilation technique, can do very well with medications that control the acid production. Now, so that's the backgrounder. Now, that's all well and good. Now, what do we do about it from a food standpoint? What was interesting when I was doing research for my own benefit, as well as my readers' benefits, is that I found that there isn't a cookie-cutter approach to every GERD patient. For example, I have a gentleman I'm taking care of where he had been told that spicy food seemed to aggravate it. He can eat spicy foods till the cows come home, and he never has an episode. Mm-hmm. So I generally don't like to make a general recommendation about avoiding a certain foods. However, there are some different basic constructs of a GERD diet that seems to help tremendously. What I find that seems to help the best is certainly eating small, frequent meals versus large meals. And are you already doing that?
Yeah, well, when I behave, yes.
When you behave, right? So that could be the magic imperative here is trying to be on your best behavior. Also not drinking a lot of fluid with your meal, so allowing those acids in the stomach to actually help digest that food, because diluting the acids can also cause indigestion, so not to have too much fluid at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely not eating a large meal before you go to bed, because quite often when people have reflux, it seems to get more exacerbated and pronounced while they're sleeping. Also having the head of your bed slightly elevated. Have you tried that?
Yeah, I just slip off of the wedge.
Right. So one other option is actually to physically raise the back of your head so you're not flipping off the ledge. But there are some foods that I feature not in this latest book, and not that I'm here to try to sell all three of my books, but in the second book called 101 Optimal Life Foods, I actually talk about what are those best foods that really can help. And not surprisingly, those foods that have high fiber, because that actually diminishes the amount of time it takes to get from stem to stern. So having less food in the digestive tract at one time is helpful. So high-fiber foods such as whole grains, fruits and vegetables, especially berries, is very helpful. Omega-3 fatty acid-rich foods such as flaxseed, fatty fish, help with reducing inflammation. And from the Barrett's esophagus, which is a progression of the acid buildup, blackberries have actually been shown to help heal the esophagus and reduce the risk of esophageal cancer.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that is a risk with Barrett's esophagus.
Mm-hmm. There's new sweetener out, xylitol or something like that. I love sugar, but I know that doesn't help, and I'm trying to avoid anything chemically made. But there's a XY something, and that's supposed to be safe.
Yeah, that's called xylitol, and that is a sugar alcohol, and that can be a very effective sweetener because it is lower in calories than regular sugar. The difficulty is consuming a lot of it, and I'm going to try to be very discreet in my description of this over the radio, but it will tend to cause a little bit of a loose bowel if you eat too much of that.
Oh,
so
okay.
I would suggest go easy. Unless you do eat a lot of it, you might want to park yourself next to your bathroom for the remainder of the day.
Yeah, well, that could be helpful for some people.
Right. There you go.
Anyway,
well, good luck to you.
Did you read the article about the implanted magnetic bracelet to help heartburn sufferers?
I have not. And I also should be very clear, it's not just diet, but physical activity, working
right.
with your doctor. There can be a lot of different things that could be beneficial.
Okay. It's in the News Gazette, April 12th.
I will look at it. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome, and thank you.
My pleasure.
What's your last name again?
Grotto, Grotto.
Okay, thank you.
My
Bye.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much, Eleanor. And we're talking with David Grotto on Focus. You mentioned earlier in the broadcast about the principles of a balanced diet, and I was wondering if we could take a little time right now just to go over what we should be looking at when we're using the phrase balanced diet. What exactly does that mean?
Well, and I think it's important to talk about that as well, because besides looking at individual foods, as you were just mentioning about Cheerios and looking at some of the health claims, we have to look at some of the health claims of kind of popular fad diets as well. So should you go Paleolithic? Should you go raw? Should you go vegan? And if we take a look at the what are called the Dietary Guidelines for Americans, which is this great think tank of health experts, nutrition experts who come together every 5 years to develop these guidelines, what we do know is that a plant-based, not necessarily a plant-only diet, is what's been shown in the research to be the most healthful. And so that means eating half of your plates of fruits and vegetables. And in fact, if you go to myplate.gov, that is one of the best free resources to find out what is an overall healthy diet. And here you will see a dinner plate divided into quadrants, half being fruits and vegetables, a quarter of that being grains, preferably whole grains, and a quarter of that being protein, particularly lean protein, so lean meats, but fatty fish is certainly okay. And then off to the right-hand side of that plate is almost looks like a Mickey Mouse minus one ear. There's actually a little cup of dairy. So we're having some low-fat dairy products. That is what's considered to be in the context of a healthy diet.
Okay. And it sounds like I think a lot of people have the mental image or habit when they eat is they look for the protein, the meat, the fish, the whatever, and then the vegetables are a supplement. But the vegetables and the fruits and vegetables maybe are more like the star.
Yes, I think what's totally changed, certainly since my parents' day, is I remember them always having this angst about what to make for dinner. And, of course, the first thing they thought of was the center of the plate, the star at that time, which was the protein, and then basically what do we fill the rest of the plate with. So the new thinking now is actually to, as you just said, who is the star of the plate? It's actually fruits and vegetables, which should take predominance, and then filling in with a healthy starch and a lower extent of the protein. It's not that we don't need protein, but the vast majority of Americans eat more protein than what they actually need.
And I guess there was a time when protein was more dear than it is now. It's pretty easy to get protein these days in America anyway.
Yes. More dear as in D-E-E-R or D-E-A-R to our hearts?
Maybe more expensive and difficult to get.
Okay, yes. Well, in fact, and back in the heyday, we used to forage more for our food, you know. So in my grandfather's day, I remember him during the Depression era having a garden. He would literally go out and hunt for venison and rabbit and so forth. Well, those days are long gone. The people who do have gardens are few and far between, and they're a mere shadow of more substantial gardens that we used to have during those periods of time. And now what happens is our foraging for food has become driving through a drive-thru at a fast food restaurant. So problems that we're having as a result of this technology and convenience is that we're not burning up the calories that we used to that would offset maybe a heavier calorie intake. So that can be a big problem. So again, I want to make sure it's clear that it's not just a healthy diet, but we really do need to marry this with good amounts of physical activity as well.
Okay. And the website, now that I've hunted it up, is actually choosemyplate.gov. And then you can find a little category just on the top left that says My Plate. And you can start finding out a little bit about the vegetable groups according to the USDA, which put this website together. And we're going to take just a quick break and go back and talk with Lindsay and David. And come back to David Grotto to talk about diet and nutrition here on Focus on WYLL.
Thank you, Jim. So I'm Lindsay Moon, Focus's producer, and I'm here today with David Teal to tell you about our spring membership drive. And we have a goal this week to raise $120,000, and we are $1,000 away from $80,000. So if you are listening right now and enjoy the programming that we bring to you here at WILL. If you enjoy the Focus program, give us a call, pick up your phone at 217-244-9455. You know, David, one of the things that I really love about Focus is that we get the opportunity to talk to experts about really practical advice. But,
Yeah. You
know, we mentioned earlier a study that he did with firefighters and heart disease, and it's those really interesting little nuggets that
Yeah. Come
out of information. That
yeah,
is.
Absolutely. And we just want to mention real quick that we are offering our guest's book today, and it's The Best Things You Can Eat. And so, you know, if you haven't been able to keep up with all this information that we're getting during the show, it's all there and much, much more, tons of lists and information, and it's available at the $75 pledge level this morning. So we hope you'll call and take advantage of that. 244-9455 is the number. WillPledge.org is the website.
That's right. And we have a goal to try and get 10 pledges this hour, and we've so far had 8. So thank you very much for the people that have already called in. Pamela, Jerry and Henry, Donald and Mary, and Nathan and Sarah, thank you very much for your pledges this hour. We also invite new listeners, people that maybe haven't pledged before, to come be a part of the WILL family. A couple of those pledges, they are new members to WILL.
And probably need to get back to the show, but we really appreciate the calls and the support this morning.
Thank you very much. We're back on Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking about good diet and nutrition today with David Grotto, author of, among other books, The Best Things You Can Eat. And we welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455. Call toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. Or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at Focus580. And David, there was one thing you always hear research about diet and nutrition, but the one that stuck in my mind the last month or so was the University of Barcelona clinical study comparing people who ate a Mediterranean diet compared to those who ate a low-fat diet. And according to its findings, those on the Mediterranean diet actually did better in terms of heart disease risk, even though that diet is higher in apparently in fats and cholesterol. This is a diet that's described as rich in olive oil, beans, nuts, fish, fruits, and vegetables. Have you looked at that study, and what do you make of it?
Well, I'm glad that you ask. I'm intimately aware of that study, and in fact, when we look at these dietary guidelines for Americans, what we're really looking at is a Mediterranean-style type of diet. Back in the 70s, when the low-fat craze got started, we saw initially that people would lose weight, their cholesterol levels were going down, and most likely more due to the weight going down. Weight is a risk factor for heart disease and elevated cholesterol and more harmful LDL cholesterol. But what we're finding is that there may be substances within the Mediterranean diet that do a much better job than just focusing on low fat. So not all fat is created equal. In fact, olive oil is very rich in what are called polyphenolic compounds, which is just a fancy word to say that there's substance in there that may actually keep the arteries more supple and less prone to developing hardening of the arteries. The type of fats also being what are called monounsaturated fats has been shown to be very effective for helping to reduce, again, this more harmful LDL cholesterol. What they've also found is that when you take saturated fat and replace it with refined carbohydrates, that is even more concerning for heart disease and may even raise LDL, the harmful cholesterol, even more substantially. So that is one of my concerns with a low-fat diet that doesn't focus in on the appropriate type of carbohydrates. If we eat more refined carbohydrates such as white bread and processed pastas and things of that nature and sugar, that may be even worse for our heart than eating a diet that's laden with saturated fat such as butter and cream and so forth.
One thing I gathered, however, for instance, I get the idea that, say, eating at an Italian restaurant is not quite the same thing as eating an actual Mediterranean diet.
That's true. Well, I think it has an awful lot to do with portion, so you can certainly have too much of a good thing. If we look at a traditional Italian diet, for example, and of course when we say Mediterranean, that's a little bit of a misnomer because there's so many regions within the Mediterranean that have a little bit of their own spin and take on the basis of the Mediterranean diet.
So that could be a lot of foods, a lot of diets, which you might think of, say, as Greek or Middle Eastern, around that region of the world.
Yes, Northern African, absolutely correct. But in context, it's still about the same as far as where those foods are coming from as far as a distribution of foods, of carbohydrates, proteins, and fat. So a Mediterranean diet is generally abundant in fruits and vegetables, a little bit less in the grain department. So even though we think of an Italian diet as being mostly pasta, if we look at a traditional Italian diet, that was really more as a side dish offering, and the focus of the plate was more of beans, legumes, again, vegetables, fruit, small amounts of meat, almost used like a condiment. And that may have a lot to do with more of an economic challenge. We've seen this even in Asian diets and South American diets that include meat, but it's more as a condiment to add flavor to the food because, quite frankly, it's a very expensive portion of the plate. So the Mediterranean diet has actually got an abundance of research behind it showing that it's not only beneficial for fighting heart disease, but certainly may be one of the answers for fighting diabetes, cancer. The list goes on and on.
Okay. Let's go to one of our callers on line one. Tom in Champaign has been waiting patiently. And good morning. You're on Focus.
Hello. I had a question. I have diverticulitis. And my doctor gave me this long list of stuff I couldn't eat. And then I read on the Mayo Clinic website that that's silly. If you keep your fiber up, you can pretty much eat anything. And I was just wondering what your take was on that. And I'll hang up and just listen to you talk.
Sure, absolutely. Well, first of all, a little background information for those of you who are wondering what is diverticulitis. So as we age... typically form little outpouches in our colon, and that can be a natural part of the aging process. There can be a genetic connection with that. But I would argue that the vast majority of people who develop something called diverticulosis, where you develop these little outpouches, is quite often due to chronic constipation and low fiber in the diet. Diverticulitis is where one of those outpouches actually become infected and may burst and can be a very painful thing. The best thing for helping to hopefully prevent that condition is to eat a high-fiber diet, be engaged in regular physical activity, and even stress, believe it or not, may play a role with that as well. It used to be a widely held belief that eating seeds and nuts may actually lodge in that little outpouch and may cause diverticulitis. The truth of the matter is there's very little research to substantiate that, and many gastroenterologists today don't necessarily always recommend to their patients that they have to avoid nuts and seeds. But again, if you've been diagnosed with diverticulosis, you are seeing a gastroenterologist, I would certainly defer to their advice. But I also talk in my book about diverticulosis, and I do recommend a very high-fiber diet, which can include nuts and seeds as well.
Okay. Now, you know, here in Champaign-Urbana, David, there is a marathon going on this weekend. It's the 5th Annual Illinois Marathon. A lot of people, there are actually going to be, I think, thousands signed up for the marathon. So I'm assuming a lot of our listeners are participating. You talked earlier about pre-workout food and even post-workout food, but what's the best pre-race meal for something, you know, something really draining like a marathon, something for an endurance athlete?
Absolutely. And in fact, my daughter, who attends the University of Illinois at Champaign, I think will be there cheering on her friends and colleagues. So, yes, there are ideal foods. And in fact, what was so nice about writing this book is not only did you get the world according to Dave Grotto, you know, I've been a nutritionist now for nearly 30 years, but I pulled in some of the best experts in the nutrition world. In fact, Nancy Clark, who is probably one of the most noted sports nutritionists in the world, actually was very helpful in assembling this. So one of my recommendations for pre- and post-workout foods, as I mentioned before, chocolate milk, probably more so afterwards, again, for that post-recovery. Now, for those that have run a marathon before, they probably already know that whatever you're going to eat for your race day diet should be something that you've been training with all along. So one of the worst things that anybody can do that's going to run something vigorous like a triathlon or a marathon is to change their game plan the day of the race. So you should always make sure you're eating the foods that you train with. But I believe some of those foods should include fermented dairy products such as yogurt and kefir. There is some research showing that those that do long-distance activities and are really engaged in very vigorous activity can actually have lowered immune systems. It can be more prone to developing colds and flus and catching the bug that comes around. So fermented foods actually help with building up your resistance. Other foods that would be great, we talked about oatmeal, not only good for helping to lower cholesterol, but it is a complex carbohydrate that can give you more long-burning energy. So a lot of people who are running marathons are often taking like these gels and goos, but you can even take a little bit of a granola mix with you and actually eat that while you're running. Bananas and are a great fruit because they're rich in potassium. Those that run marathons often develop muscle and calf pain, and that can be due to depletion of certain nutrients such as potassium. And then my last favorite fruit would be cherries. Cherries are very rich in something called ellagic acid, which has been good to help ward off runner's knee. So that pain that you get in the joints can actually be benefited from tart cherries.
Okay, and my producer, Lindsay Moon, who's competing in the marathon relay part of the Illinois Marathon, has been nodding along as you gave the tip. So I'm sure they're registering.
Lindsay.
Yes, exactly. Well, we're going to go back now to Lindsay Moon and David Teal for just 2 or 3 minutes to talk a little more about the pledge drive that's going on now that makes programs like Focus possible.
Right. Thank you, Jim. So this morning we are in our spring pledge drive. We have a goal of $120,000, and when we reach that goal, we are going to stop the drive. This morning we are about $700 short of $80,000, and we made it a goal at the beginning of this hour on Focus to have 10 pledges this hour, and so far we have had 9. So
that is great. It is just awesome. We're really gratified by the response that we're getting this morning. Obviously, some terrific information from our guest. You know, if you'd like more of that, we do have the book, and it's The Best Things You Can Eat by David Grotto. It's available at the $75 pledge level this morning. Again, just a wealth of information in here. And, listening to the program, Lindsay, I mean, I've heard so many goofy fad diets over the years and some really dubious information about what you should be eating. And this sounds very sensible, and it's nice to hear. You know,
I agree. And, you know, I produce the show and have been through the book and have talked with Jim about some of the questions we can pull out of it. And, you know, one of the things that I love about this book is that it's a guide and has lots of really great lists, but there are also little tidbits hidden inside it about ways that you can prepare foods that might seem unhealthy to make them better for you. There are little boxes called shocker foods and give ways to maybe prepare French fries without extra oil and things like that. So
that's available at the $75 level this morning. But the important thing is that we hear from you. I mean, because, you know, we really do all of this for you. our listeners. You know, I mean, it's something that, sure, you know, we get paid and we love our jobs, but, you know, we also really, you know, enjoy the fact that you know, at the end of the day, we feel like, you know, we can do something, we can give something back to the community. We hope that you can help us out this morning with your pledge. Call 244-9455 in the 217 area code. You can give online at willpledge.org, and a lot of people are doing that now as we, you know, of course, more and more people listen online.
Right. So we'll get back to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Lindsay. Thank you, David. And Jim Meadows here on Focus with David Grotto, nutritionist and dietitian and author of The Best Things You Can Eat. We had an email come in at will-talk@illinois.edu. Mike asks, if you could address how storing of food affects vitamin and nutrient content. He writes, specifically, I start out each week by throwing carrots, red cabbage, peppers, etc. into a food processor and use the resulting melange throughout the week. By the end of the work week, does this salad have nutritional value left?
That's a great question. You know, I was thinking for my next book, I was kind of, you know, this book actually is a compendium of 60 good-for-you food lists, and perhaps the 61st one would have been, what are the best foods to help you survive into the next pledge drive? Hey, that would have been good. but to answer the question about fruits and vegetables, we're really suggesting that you eat fruits and vegetables on a daily basis. Well, we are suggesting. The recommendations are to eat fruits and vegetables every single day. They're called perishables for a reason, because they do succumb to what's called oxidation. So when you cut open an apple or you break apart lettuce and so forth, the elements will actually start working on breaking down and degrading that food. So you start losing some nutritional value right at the time that you harvest and supply it. But it's very insignificant. The problem is, once you get to a point where you're putting it through a food processor and so forth, that fruit and vegetable really should be consumed on that day. If you keep it for longer than a couple of days, you do lose some substantial amount of nutrients to it. Now, the good news is frozen fruits and vegetables, in fact, there was a recent study that showed that they may have as much nutrition, if not even more nutrition than fresh, and I know which is a little bit mind-boggling, but the concept is that when they pick fruits and vegetables at the peak of ripeness, it has the most amount of nutrition. By freezing it, it's almost like a suspended animation. You've actually preserved that nutrition. Now, that's not for infinitum. You will lose nutrition if something gets stored in the freezer for, let's say, longer than 3 months. So I always recommend consume frozen fruits and vegetables within a 3-month period of time. But ideally, you should prepare vegetables fresh. That includes, you know, using frozen vegetables fresh, consuming them within the next day or two.
Now, that raises the questions then about canned fruits and vegetables, which, besides not being frozen, have also probably been cooked. What's the situation with them?
Well, that's also kind of an old wives' tale that many of my patients have said, well, I avoid canned vegetables and fruit because I know that they lack in nutrition. Canning is actually just another way of preserving, much like freezing. Now, truth be told, freezing has a slight nutritional advantage compared to canned, but I'm here to share the good news that eating canned fruits and vegetables absolutely has good nutrition value to it. But it's the same thing. Once you've opened them up, they should be consumed within the next day or two. Now, the downside of canned fruits and vegetables is that many of them on the market can be loaded with sugar or loaded with salt. But the good news is the canning process technology has evolved where there are a lot more low-sodium and low-sugar offerings, and that's what I would recommend that consumers choose.
We had the instance in recent months of New York City Mayor David Bloomberg attempting to ban the sale of giant-sized sugary soft drinks in his city, and it was struck down ultimately by a court. But how do you feel about efforts like that to try to make large public restrictions on what sort of food quantities are sold?
Well, that's a great question. I also give New Yorkers a lot more credit for their smarts. I think if they're banned from having 32-ounce beverages, would they not buy 2 16-ounce beverages if they were truly thirsty and wanted to have that beverage? So I really do think kind of big regulation such as that doesn't really get to the root cause. What I do know, though, is that we have greater access to high-calorie foods that are low in nutrients than ever before. So I'm 53 years old. I know when I was growing up, did I eat things like McDonald's and drink sugary beverages and so forth? What's happened over time is that used to be a treat. Now it's become an everyday part of life for many Americans. And again, because it's so easily accessible. So I am a strong proponent of banning foods like this from, let's say, public vending machines, certainly schools. There's a whole problem with competitive foods, meaning that students may have access to purchasing those foods that are very high in fat and calories, and they may not have a lot of nutrition value, and often will choose that over, let's say, their standard national school lunch program. So that can be a big problem. But I don't think putting a ban on a quantity of food is going to solve the obesity epidemic. I think what will help with it is that, again, if we can go ahead and implement public policy and encourage more healthy food innovations, getting those into the schools, public vending machines, and then if people really want to go out and seek out something that's not as nutritious, they can certainly do it. I'm in much better favor of taxing something that is deleterious to our health, making it cost prohibitive, much like cigarettes. I think that would make a lot more sense than actually telling people how much quantity they can purchase.
David Grotto is a registered dietitian and licensed dietitian and nutritionist and a former national spokesman for the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. He writes online at David Grotto's Nutrition House Call, and his books include his latest, The Best Things You Can Eat. David Grotto, thanks for coming back and talking with us today on Focus.
My pleasure.
And I would like to say thank you to Jerry in Champaign and Greta in Urbana for your pledges during this hour and your support of Focus. We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go to it at will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's show produced by Lindsay Moon. Other members of our Focus team are Pam Dempsey and Kimberly Cronick. Mike Pritchard is our technical director and handles your calls. Friday on Focus, two women with lots to say about the benefits of good health and exercise. In the first half of the hour, I'll talk with New York Times personal health columnist Jaden Brody. In the second half, an interview recorded earlier this week with Catherine Switzer. She's the first woman to register and run in the Boston Marathon, and she is the guest legend runner in this weekend's Illinois Marathon in Champaign-Urbana. That's Jane Brody and Catherine Switzer, both on tomorrow's show. Focus is live each weekday morning at 10 on AM 580 with a replay at 8 p.m. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WILL.